This is the Cambridge Assessment International Education, Cambridge IGCSE, June 2021 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Exercise 1. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. How long did the girls' art course last? B. What did the girl most enjoy making on the art course?
How was your school holiday?
It was great, actually. I did so much that it seemed to last much longer than 6 weeks. I spent a week at home to begin with, then I did a fantastic full-time art course.
What? For the other 5 weeks?
3 weeks, actually. For the final 2 weeks, I went to stay with my grandparents.
So the course was good then?
Brilliant. I'd never produced a sculpture before, so doing that was probably the highlight for me. But I loved doing portraits too. Creating jewellery was also fun, but it seemed a bit of an odd thing to include in an art course.
How was your school holiday?
It was great, actually. I did so much that it seemed to last much longer than 6 weeks. I spent a week at home to begin with, then I did a fantastic full-time art course.
What? For the other 5 weeks?
3 weeks, actually. For the final 2 weeks, I went to stay with my grandparents.
So the course was good then?
Brilliant. I'd never produced a sculpture before, so doing that was probably the highlight for me. But I loved doing portraits too. Creating jewellery was also fun, but it seemed a bit of an odd thing to include in an art course.
Question 2. A. Who did the boy go to the shopping mall with? B. Which shop did the boy spend the most time in?
I went to that new shopping mall this weekend.
Oh, is it any good?
It's great. I was a bit worried about going with my sister, though, because we always end up having to go wherever she wants. Anyway, she felt ill that morning, so my parents and I went while she stayed at home.
Did you buy anything?
I did. We went there mainly to get me some new trainers. It took forever to try them all on and choose a pair because the sports shop had so many. That didn't leave much time to check out the game shop, where I'd have spent all day if I could have. I went to that new shopping mall this weekend.
Oh, is it any good?
It's great. I was a bit worried about going with my sister, though, because we always end up having to go wherever she wants. Anyway, she felt ill that morning, so my parents and I went while she stayed at home.
Did you buy anything?
I did. We went there mainly to get me some new trainers. It took forever to try them all on and choose a pair because the sports shop had so many. That didn't leave much time to check out the game shop, where I'd have spent all day if I could have.
Question 3. A. Who recommended the book to the girl? B. What does the girl think is the best thing about the book?
In my presentation, I'm going to tell you about a book I've read recently. My best friend sometimes suggests things to read, though her taste is different from mine, so I tend to check out what my cousin's reading instead. He and I generally like similar things. This time, though, she kept talking about this book so much I finally gave in and read it. It's about a search for a lost continent hidden under Antarctica. The characters are incredibly interesting, although there aren't too many surprises as far as the story goes, especially the ending, which is rather predictable. In my presentation, I'm going to tell you about a book I've read recently. My best friend sometimes suggests things to read, though her taste is different from mine, so I tend to check out what my cousin's reading instead. He and I generally like similar things. This time, though, she kept talking about this book so much I finally gave in and read it. It's about a search for a lost continent hidden under Antarctica. The characters are incredibly interesting, although there aren't too many surprises as far as the story goes, especially the ending, which is rather predictable.
Question 4. A. On which day of the week will the boys' concert take place? B. How will the boys' mum help at the concert?
Mum, could you possibly pick me up from school on Wednesday next week? I'll be staying late to practice for the concert.
That's the 17th of June, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The actual performance is the following week on the Thursday, just before we finish for the long school holiday on that Friday.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to it. I offered to help out at the concert, like last year. I thought I'd be asked to give them a hand serving drinks again at the little stall they set up during the interval. Anyway, I'm selling tickets this year, which will be much easier.
Mum, could you possibly pick me up from school on Wednesday next week? I'll be staying late to practice for the concert.
That's the 17th of June, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The actual performance is the following week on the Thursday, just before we finish for the long school holiday on that Friday.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to it. I offered to help out at the concert, like last year. I thought I'd be asked to give them a hand serving drinks again at the little stall they set up during the interval. Anyway, I'm selling tickets this year, which will be much easier.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 2. You will hear Carol Mendez, the director of a chain of cafes, giving a talk about the history of coffee. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Hello, I'm Carol Mendez, director of a chain of cafes. I've come to talk to you today about a really successful product, coffee. There are many different stories about how coffee was discovered. What they all have in common is that it was first drunk in Ethiopia in Africa. The first accurate historical records of coffee drinking date back to the 15th century. However, a popular tale identifies the 9th century as when coffee was originally consumed as a drink. By the 17th century, it was being enjoyed all over the world. According to the tale, it was an Ethiopian farmer called Kaldi who realised the benefits of coffee. He spotted that his goats, which he spent his time protecting from predators such as wolves and eagles, became energetic and didn't sleep once they'd consumed the red beans, coffee beans, growing on small trees found in the region. When he left the mountains, Kaldi took some of the beans with him. In those days, there was no such thing as a professional chef, so instead he gave them to a local leader
who initially disapproved of them and threw them onto a fire. The smell of the roasting beans changed his mind, however, and he used them to produce a delicious hot drink. News about coffee spread, and before long it was being drunk in Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Not only was it enjoyed in people's homes, but also in the world's earliest coffee shops. Customers would enjoy watching musicians or short plays, or even playing chess at the same time as having a coffee. As the popularity of coffee extended into Europe, coffee shops appeared there too and became centres of social activity. In England, for example, customers fondly referred to them as penny universities, because for this small amount of money, they could buy a cup of coffee and learn a great deal by engaging in stimulating conversation. It's strikingly similar to the name given to Middle Eastern coffee shops, which roughly translates as wisdom schools. Later, the British took coffee to North America. Coffee and other drinks, such as milk, avoided the heavy tax imposed in 1773 on tea, which then became unaffordable for most people. This caused massive social conflict and forever changed the American drinking preference to coffee. There's an interesting story associated with the introduction of coffee to what's now the world's biggest coffee producer, Brazil. The French had already started growing coffee in nearby French Guiana. A soldier called Francisco Palheta was sent there from Brazil to get some coffee plants. However, the French were unwilling to share, and security was so tight that there was little chance of Palheta hiding any plants or seeds in his luggage. Luckily, the French governor's wife liked Palheta and gave him a bunch of flowers before he left. Buried inside were enough coffee seeds to begin coffee production in Brazil. Although coffee isn't even in the world's top 10 industries in terms of the money it generates, it's still big. At almost $30 billion annually, it may seem tiny compared to the $900 billion generated by oil and the $170 billion per year created by gold, but it's still highly profitable.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Hello, I'm Carol Mendez, director of a chain of cafes. I've come to talk to you today about a really successful product, coffee. There are many different stories about how coffee was discovered. What they all have in common is that it was first drunk in Ethiopia, in Africa. The first accurate historical records of coffee drinking date back to the 15th century. However, a popular tale identifies the 9th century as when coffee was originally consumed as a drink. By the 17th century, it was being enjoyed all over the world. According to the tale, it was an Ethiopian farmer called Kaldi who realized the benefits of coffee. He spotted that his goats, which he spent his time protecting from predators such as wolves and eagles, became energetic and didn't sleep once they'd consumed the red beans, coffee beans, growing on small trees found in the region. When he left the mountains, Kaldi took some of the beans with him. In those days, there was no such thing as a professional chef, so instead he gave them to a local leader, who initially disapproved of them and threw them onto a fire. The smell of the roasting beans changed his mind, however, and he used them to produce a delicious hot drink. News about coffee spread, and before long, it was being drunk in Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Not only was it enjoyed in people's homes, but also in the world's earliest coffee shops. Customers would enjoy watching musicians or short plays, or even playing chess at the same time as having a coffee. As the popularity of coffee extended into Europe, coffee shops appeared there too and became centres of social activity. In England, for example, customers fondly referred to them as penny universities, because for this small amount of money, they could buy a cup of coffee and learn a great deal by engaging in stimulating conversation. It's strikingly similar to the name given to Middle Eastern coffee shops, which roughly translates as wisdom schools. Later, the British took coffee to North America. Coffee and other drinks, such as milk, avoided the heavy tax imposed in 1773 on tea, which then became unaffordable for most people. This caused massive social conflict and forever changed the American drinking preference to coffee. There's an interesting story associated with the introduction of coffee to what's now the world's biggest coffee producer, Brazil. The French had already started growing coffee in nearby French Guiana. A soldier called Francisco Palheta was sent there from Brazil to get some coffee plants. However, the French were unwilling to share, and security was so tight that there was little chance of Palheta hiding any plants or seeds in his luggage. Luckily, the French governor's wife liked Palheta and gave him a bunch of flowers before he left. Buried inside were enough coffee seeds to begin coffee production in Brazil. Although coffee isn't even in the world's top 10 industries in terms of the money it generates, it's still big. At almost $30 billion annually, it may seem tiny compared to the $900 billion generated by oil and the $170 billion per year created by gold, but it's still highly profitable.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear exercise 3. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 3. You will hear 6 people talking about recent changes they have made in their lives. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list, A to G, which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I finished school last year and now have a good job. I was determined to go to university when I left school, even though most of my friends had decided against an academic life. The day before I was due to begin my course, I felt incredibly anxious and realised my friends had made the right choice. So I let the university know and started looking for work instead. In general, I think I made the right decision, but I do sometimes wonder what life would have been like if I'd continued studying.
Speaker 2.
I'd always lived in a village until I moved to the capital city. Although I loved living close to my friends and family, I was bored with village life and knew there were so many exciting opportunities in the city. Moving somewhere much bigger frightened me, though, so I kept putting off the decision, which was a big mistake. Eventually, a relative who has a business in the capital asked if I wanted to go and work for her. I accepted without even bothering to ask anyone else's opinion.
Speaker 3.
I love working as an engineer, so when the company I worked for went out of business last year, I was very upset. There weren't any other engineering firms in my area, and as I really didn't want to move away from my family, I decided to set up my own business instead. I imagined my friends and family would try to persuade me against the idea, but they surprised me. To be honest, I'd have been happier continuing to work for someone else, but it's worked out pretty well.
Speaker 4.
I've always been good at sports, and about a year ago was playing football at quite a high level. I even dreamed of going professional one day. Then some friends suggested I try rock climbing. I decided to go with them one weekend, and since then I've hardly played a single football match, as I now spend all my free time climbing. I don't miss my former sport at all these days. There's little point wishing I'd discovered rock climbing earlier. After all, we can't change the past.
Speaker 5.
Last year, I decided to move to another country. My closest friends tried to convince me it wasn't the right thing to do, but it wasn't something I just rushed into without serious thought. I know there are lots of blogs these days by people who've done a similar thing, but I wanted to avoid being influenced by someone else's experience, so didn't bother reading any. Obviously, making such a massive change isn't going to happen without me having a few regrets, but on the whole, it's been very positive.
Speaker 6.
I was fed up spending hours travelling to and from work by train every day, so I bought a car. Everyone says travelling by car's less environmentally friendly, but my family could see the effect my daily train journey was having on me, so they supported my decision. The difference is amazing. I have more free time now and am far less stressed. It's just a pity it's so expensive. I did need some guidance, though, and couldn't have bought one without the support of many of my friends, as I knew nothing about cars.
Now you will hear the 6 speakers again. Speaker 1.
I finished school last year and now have a good job. I was determined to go to university when I left school, even though most of my friends had decided against an academic life. The day before I was due to begin my course, I felt incredibly anxious and realised my friends had made the right choice. So I let the university know and started looking for work instead. In general, I think I made the right decision, but I do sometimes wonder what life would have been like if I'd continued studying.
Speaker 2.
I'd always lived in a village until I moved to the capital city. Although I loved living close to my friends and family, I was bored with village life and knew there were so many exciting opportunities in the city. Moving somewhere much bigger frightened me, though, so I kept putting off the decision, which was a big mistake. Eventually, a relative who has a business in the capital asked if I wanted to go and work for her. I accepted without even bothering to ask anyone else's opinion.
Speaker 3.
I love working as an engineer, so when the company I worked for went out of business last year, I was very upset. There weren't any other engineering firms in my area, and as I really didn't want to move away from my family, I decided to set up my own business instead. I imagined my friends and family would try to persuade me against the idea, but they surprised me. To be honest, I'd have been happier continuing to work for someone else, but it's worked out pretty well.
Speaker 4.
I've always been good at sports, and about a year ago was playing football at quite a high level. I even dreamed of going professional one day. Then some friends suggested I try rock climbing. I decided to go with them one weekend, and since then I've hardly played a single football match, as I now spend all my free time climbing. I don't miss my former sport at all these days. There's little point wishing I'd discovered rock climbing earlier. After all, we can't change the past.
Speaker 5.
Last year, I decided to move to another country. My closest friends tried to convince me it wasn't the right thing to do, but it wasn't something I just rushed into without serious thought. I know there are lots of blogs these days by people who've done a similar thing, but I wanted to avoid being influenced by someone else's experience, so didn't bother reading any. Obviously, making such a massive change isn't going to happen without me having a few regrets, but on the whole, it's been very positive.
Speaker 6.
I was fed up spending hours travelling to and from work by train every day, so I bought a car. Everyone says travelling by car's less environmentally friendly, but my family could see the effect my daily train journey was having on me, so they supported my decision. The difference is amazing. I have more free time now and am far less stressed. It's just a pity it's so expensive. I did need some guidance, though, and couldn't have bought one without the support of many of my friends, as I knew nothing about cars.
That is the end of exercise 3. In a moment, you will hear exercise 4. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 4. You will hear a radio presenter interviewing an underwater filmmaker called Max Elliott. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
I'd like to welcome underwater filmmaker Max Elliott to today's show. Max, your nature documentaries are in demand around the world. What's made them so successful?
Viewers' tastes have changed. They're not so bothered nowadays about seeing technically perfect films that look great but don't say much. They want the creatures in films to be almost like heroes in a novel and to learn about the everyday dramas of their lives. I aim to do this in all my films, whether it's the first time the creatures in question have been filmed, or if they've appeared in programmes many times before.
And how long does it take to plan a film trip?
About a year. It sounds a lot, but I can hardly just book plane tickets, turn up and start filming. Finding out about the creatures I'm going to be filming is key, so I do that before anything else. Where they live and the conditions I'll find there tell me exactly what cameras and other stuff I'll need to take.
You've filmed in some of the coldest places on Earth, even beneath ice, haven't you?
Diving underneath ice is incredible. Surprisingly, I don't breathe as quickly there as in other locations because I feel pretty relaxed. The ice is so thick, it cuts out lots of the natural light. When you see the documentaries that have been filmed there, it looks really bright, but that's because artificial lighting's been used to film the surprising amount of life that's found down there.
What's the most difficult aspect of filming underwater?
It's dangerous for dives to last much more than an hour, which is what puts most pressure on me. Getting close to what you're filming without disturbing or harming any other wildlife is hard when you only have that long. 50 years ago, I'd have said it was coping with damage to equipment caused by seawater. Anything metal goes rusty incredibly quickly because of the salt, but that's less of an issue these days thanks to design improvements.
You often spend months far from home filming. How is that?
I'm not sure it's something I'll ever get used to. I can forget about it on days that I'm really busy, but there aren't that many of those on a long trip. I'd love to fly back during short breaks in filming, but we're often travelling to other destinations then. The ideal would be for my wife and children to come with me. I'm sure they'd enjoy it.
Are there any qualities every good underwater filmmaker should have?
People who don't dive assume that filming underwater is really stressful, whereas I actually feel as at home there as I do above it. Nature's unpredictable, so things don't often go according to plan. Anyone working in my field has to be good at sorting these difficulties out, and quickly. Being able to work in a team's essential, but you're only one small part of it, not in charge.
Which of your films do you take most pride in?
Filming whales off New Zealand and Mexico was the most enjoyable experience I've had, although I'm not sure the documentaries that resulted from this were my best. The animals I keep returning to are sharks. They're so powerful and elegant, which really brings out the best in me as a filmmaker. And it's always great fun filming seals. People seem to love watching footage of them swimming and playing together under the water.
Are there any suggestions you'd make to people who want to get a job like yours?
You get work by creating good films. The mistake people make is to spend whatever money they have paying for expensive cameras and a week filming in an exotic location. They end up with one film, which may or may not be any good. Improving your abilities by working on a range of projects nearer to where you live is a much better idea. You can't compete with filmmakers you admire who spend months in one place getting the perfect shot.
Thanks, Max.
Now you will hear the interview again.
I'd like to welcome underwater filmmaker Max Elliott to today's show. Max, your nature documentaries are in demand around the world. What's made them so successful?
Viewers' tastes have changed. They're not so bothered nowadays about seeing technically perfect films that look great but don't say much. They want the creatures in films to be almost like heroes in a novel and to learn about the everyday dramas of their lives. I aim to do this in all my films, whether it's the first time the creatures in question have been filmed or if they've appeared in programmes many times before.
And how long does it take to plan a film trip?
About a year. It sounds a lot, but I can hardly just book plane tickets, turn up and start filming. Finding out about the creatures I'm going to be filming is key, so I do that before anything else. Where they live and the conditions I'll find there tell me exactly what cameras and other stuff I'll need to take.
You've filmed in some of the coldest places on Earth, even beneath ice, haven't you?
Diving underneath ice is incredible. Surprisingly, I don't breathe as quickly there as in other locations because I feel pretty relaxed. The ice is so thick, it cuts out lots of the natural light. When you see the documentaries that have been filmed there, it looks really bright, but that's because artificial lighting's been used to film the surprising amount of life that's found down there.
What's the most difficult aspect of filming underwater?
It's dangerous for dives to last much more than an hour, which is what puts most pressure on me. Getting close to what you're filming without disturbing or harming any other wildlife is hard when you only have that long. 50 years ago, I'd have said it was coping with damage to equipment caused by seawater. Anything metal goes rusty incredibly quickly because of the salt. But that's less of an issue these days thanks to design improvements.
You often spend months far from home filming. How is that?
I'm not sure it's something I'll ever get used to. I can forget about it on days that I'm really busy, but there aren't that many of those on a long trip. I'd love to fly back during short breaks in filming, but we're often travelling to other destinations then. The ideal would be for my wife and children to come with me. I'm sure they'd enjoy it.
Are there any qualities every good underwater filmmaker should have?
People who don't dive assume that filming underwater is really stressful, whereas I actually feel as at home there as I do above it. Nature's unpredictable, so things don't often go according to plan. Anyone working in my field has to be good at sorting these difficulties out, and quickly. Being able to work in a team's essential, but you're only one small part of it, not in charge.
Which of your films do you take most pride in?
Filming whales off New Zealand and Mexico was the most enjoyable experience I've had, although I'm not sure the documentaries that resulted from this were my best. The animals I keep returning to are sharks. They're so powerful and elegant, which really brings out the best in me as a filmmaker. And it's always great fun filming seals. People seem to love watching footage of them swimming and playing together under the water.
Are there any suggestions you'd make to people who want to get a job like yours?
You get work by creating good films. The mistake people make is to spend whatever money they have paying for expensive cameras and a week filming in an exotic location. They end up with one film, which may or may not be any good. Improving your abilities by working on a range of projects nearer to where you live is a much better idea. You can't compete with filmmakers you admire who spend months in one place getting the perfect shot.
Thanks, Max.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear exercise 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 5, Part A. You will hear a woman giving a talk about the development of helicopters. Listen to the talk and complete the notes in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Transport Museum. I hope you enjoy my talk today, which is all about helicopters. My guess is that the majority of you present today believe helicopters to be a modern invention. Well, the earliest surviving helicopter designs, dating back many centuries, were created by the artist and designer Leonardo da Vinci. Trade between nations was expanding at this time, and wooden toys resembling helicopters were imported from China into a number of European countries, including da Vinci's home country of Italy. It's believed it was these that gave Da Vinci the idea for his helicopter drawings. Da Vinci's designs were never made, and certainly weren't called helicopters. In fact, French flight enthusiast Gustave de Ponton came up with the term helicopter around 400 years later to describe a model he'd made that could fly up and down vertically. While previous designs had used methods such as a long string pulled by a person to provide the lift, this working model relied on a metal spring. This was similar to those used in a clock. 19th century American inventor Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb amongst many other things, but never developed a successful helicopter. He experimented with an early form of an engine that's still used on modern helicopters, but made a mistake with the fuel he chose. It was highly explosive and caused an accident in his lab. He gave up on helicopter design soon after. In 1908, American-German inventor Emil Berliner created the first helicopter that carried people. It had two engines mounted on a platform and reportedly lifted Berliner and another man about a metre off the ground. Unlike other machines of the time, for which weight was a major issue, the stability of this innovative helicopter was its principal limitation. The man who has long been known as the father of helicopters was Igor Sikorsky. He created the world's first mass-produced helicopter and set the basic design for most modern helicopters. He was an enthusiast who turned helicopters from being aeroplanes of the future into reality. He liked to tell anyone who'd listen that they'd one day replace motor cars in people's lives, and although his dream hasn't quite matched up to reality, helicopters are undoubtedly incredibly important to us today. I hope you enjoyed the talk. Does anyone have any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Transport Museum. I hope you enjoy my talk today, which is all about helicopters. My guess is that the majority of you present today believe helicopters to be a modern invention. Well, the earliest surviving helicopter designs, dating back many centuries, were created by the artist and designer Leonardo da Vinci. Trade between nations was expanding at this time, and wooden toys resembling helicopters were imported from China into a number of European countries, including Da Vinci's home country of Italy. It's believed it was these that gave Da Vinci the idea for his helicopter drawings. Da Vinci's designs were never made, and certainly weren't called helicopters. In fact, French flight enthusiast Gustave de Ponton came up with the term helicopter around 400 years later to describe a model he'd made that could fly up and down vertically. While previous designs had used methods such as a long string pulled by a person to provide the lift, this working model relied on a metal spring. This was similar to those used in a clock. 19th century American inventor Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb, amongst many other things, but never developed a successful helicopter. He experimented with an early form of an engine that's still used on modern helicopters, but made a mistake with the fuel he chose. It was highly explosive and caused an accident in his lab. He gave up on helicopter design soon after. In 1908, American-German inventor Emil Berliner created the first helicopter that carried people. It had two engines mounted on a platform and reportedly lifted Berliner and another man about a metre off the ground. Unlike other machines of the time, for which weight was a major issue, the stability of this innovative helicopter was its principal limitation. The man who has long been known as the father of helicopters was Igor Sikorsky. He created the world's first mass-produced helicopter and set the basic design for most modern helicopters. He was an enthusiast who turned helicopters from being aeroplanes of the future into reality. He liked to tell anyone who'd listen that they'd one day replace motor cars in people's lives, and although his dream hasn't quite matched up to reality, helicopters are undoubtedly incredibly important to us today. I hope you enjoyed the talk. Does anyone have any questions?
Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students, Michael and Anna, about the future of air travel, and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
Hi, Anna.
Hello, Michael. Wasn't that talk about helicopters great? She didn't say much about the future of air travel, though, which is what our project's about.
No, but we saw lots of displays at the museum about that. One of the most interesting was about how much safer aircraft have become. It's advances in construction materials that have made the most significant impact, although developments in the reliability of engines and in the control systems they use have also had an effect.
Yes, and that exhibit about how people will deal with having more and more aircraft in the skies at any one time was great. Apparently, there'll soon be insufficient numbers of pilots to cope with the rapidly increasing volume of air traffic. It takes about 20 times longer to train them than it does cabin crew, which is what's driving the move to automating aircraft.
I loved the section about improving the efficiency of aircraft too. There are obvious things that manufacturers can do, like putting in fewer seats.
Yes, but that'd mean less income for airlines, as they wouldn't be able to take as many passengers.
True, which is why aircraft without windows is the way forward. There'd still be some at the front, of course, but for passengers, they'd be replaced by screens showing what's outside.
I'm not sure I'd like that. Anyway, there are already so many other scientific advancements just waiting to be put into practice. Development of aircraft would be much more rapid if it weren't for the financial limitations that developers come up against.
And who knows what kind of machine they'd be able to create if they didn't have to deal with that sort of thing. Then we'd have far more aircraft used as public transport within cities.
Probably.
There was a display in the museum about how this idea is starting to become a possibility. I'm sure it'll completely change commuting to and from work for the better.
That goes without saying.
There'd be loads of other benefits too, not least of which is that it'd promote greater equality, I think.
Really? But how would that be possible?
Apparently, airborne public transport wouldn't run along limited routes, so it'd open up all areas of the city and make a difference even for people living in even the poorest neighbourhoods.
Let's hope it happens then.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
Hi, Anna.
Hello, Michael. Wasn't that talk about helicopters great? She didn't say much about the future of air travel, though, which is what our project's about.
No, but we saw lots of displays at the museum about that. One of the most interesting was about how much safer aircraft have become. It's advances in construction materials that have made the most significant impact, although developments in the reliability of engines and in the control systems they use have also had an effect.
Yes, and that exhibit about how people will deal with having more and more aircraft in the skies at any one time was great. Apparently, there'll soon be insufficient numbers of pilots to cope with the rapidly increasing volume of air traffic. It takes about 20 times longer to train them than it does cabin crew, which is what's driving the move to automating aircraft.
I loved the section about improving the efficiency of aircraft too. There are obvious things that manufacturers can do, like putting in fewer seats.
Yes, but that'd mean less income for airlines, as they wouldn't be able to take as many passengers.
True, which is why aircraft without windows is the way forward. There'd still be some at the front, of course, but for passengers, they'd be replaced by screens showing what's outside.
I'm not sure I'd like that. Anyway, there are already so many other scientific advancements just waiting to be put into practice. Development of aircraft would be much more rapid if it weren't for the financial limitations that developers come up against.
And who knows what kind of machine they'd be able to create if they didn't have to deal with that sort of thing. Then we'd have far more aircraft used as public transport within cities.
Probably.
There was a display in the museum about how this idea is starting to become a possibility. I'm sure it'll completely change commuting to and from work for the better.
That goes without saying.
There'd be loads of other benefits too, not least of which is that it'd promote greater equality, I think.
Really? But how would that be possible?
Apparently, airborne public transport wouldn't run along limited routes, so it'd open up all areas of the city and make a difference even for people living in even the poorest neighbourhoods.
Let's hope it happens then.
That is the end of Exercise 5, and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.